And I ain't seen the sunshine since I don't know when. I'm stuck in Folsom Prison, and time keeps dragging on. But that train keeps rolling on down to San Antone.
Yes, I hope there's a train rolling right on by Paul Manafort's jail cell. Hope he's got a nice, comfortable, you know, 6x9 little hovel there with the metal toilet with no seat and the sink that he does his laundry in, and of course, a roommate. Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickssmithshow.com. I still don't think it was long enough, but 7.5 years for someone who is going to be 70 years old in a couple of days, I guess is a fairly long sentence. And here to share some thoughts on the sentencing and also to discuss the dreaded I word, I've asked our good friend Sarah Kendzior to come talk with us, share some thoughts. She's the host of Gaslit Nation, also the author of the best-selling book, The View from Flyover Country. Sarah, thanks for taking time for us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
You know, that's kind of how I view today. Thanks for that.
Yeah, no, I was listening, you know, to you playing Folsom Prison, and I'm thinking, you got the wrong song. Like, you need redemption. You need, like, I saw through the tricks of 666, because that's been, like, that's the line that describes this week, is just that song. It's just rough.
I will most certainly look that one up. But, you know, here's the thing. Is 7.5 years, is that enough? The 43, the 47, the 43 months, is that enough?
Oh, hell no. I mean, originally, when they were talking about the potential amount of time that Manafort would do for his multitude of brutal offenses and theft, it was said to be about 305 years. I personally think that is not enough time, but that would certainly kind of reflect the severity of it. And, of course, he walks away with only 7 years, which is not enough. You know, I'm still worried about pardons. I'm worried about him just being released early for random reasons, because what people should get out of what happened is, you know, the nullification of a transparent and safe judicial process. You know, I obviously do not like Judge Ellis, who said that Manafort had led an otherwise blameless life. You know, this is someone who had helped dictators and oligarchs and torturers. He ran, you know, a group called the Torturers Lobby. This is a man with blood all over his hands. And he was praised by that judge. But back in the summer, you know, Judge Ellis was threatened. He had to have a security detail when he was doing Manafort's trial. The jury of that trial was threatened, and Judge Ellis was worried about their life. You know, he spoke directly to the press about this. There are articles about this. They're not cited much anymore. Judge Amy Berman Jackson was also threatened. She was threatened by Roger Stone multiple times, and nothing has really happened to him. You know, he barely has a gag order on him. And so, you know, while I think one judge appears to be fairly corrupt, or at the least biased, Judge Ellis, and another judge, you know, seems to be a, you know, an honorable person, Judge Berman Jackson, both of them gave a very minimal sentence for enormous crimes. Both of them gave sentences that were, in Ellis's case, far below the recommended guidelines, and in Berman Jackson's case, still below them. And I think that it shows, you know, we are living in a mafia state. And Paul Manafort is a lifetime member of a transnational mafia syndicate that used the exact sort of brutal tactics that he himself employed in his lifetime. And it is those tactics that I think ultimately prevented him from a more severe punishment. And I still sort of feel, I do feel, that he's going to weasel his way out with the help of his colleagues, which include the President of the United States, who absolutely, you know, sanctions these brutal and corrupt practices.
Yeah, do you think that's possible? Because I've read that, you know, federal sentences you have to serve, I think it's like 80-85% of whatever the sentence is. So there's no, you know, parole boards to let you out early. So there, you know, there's the talk, unless he's pardoned come November of 2020, He's going to serve at least 80-85% of that, don't you?
Yeah, I mean, folks also thought he was going to get 19 to 24 years for that first sentence. People thought Trump couldn't get elected. They thought if Trump committed crime in public and, say, confessed it on national television, he'd be indicted. I mean, I don't want to say, like, you know, throw the rule of law out the window, because I want the rule of law to be followed. You know, and as I've said many times before, you should expect autocracy but not accept it. And in this case, I don't think it's necessarily wise to assume that the normal rules of law will apply to Manafort, whether it comes to parole or pardons or anything. I mean, I think that we're in a kind of unprecedented anything-goes situation, and it's up to officials to be vigilant and to make sure that the rule of law is upheld, because I think what a lot of folks are missing in the Paul Manafort, which is that he is a public safety threat. You know, he is someone who has brutalized countless people and has threatened, you know, my friend Andrea, you know, who's been on your show, my co-host of Gaslit Nation, threatened, you know, her sister, you know, threatened us in a way that I can't quite get into, you know, here yet. You know, and it is a danger. You know, he is a merciless, terrible person. There's an article about him recently in the LA Review of Books about how he raped his wife repeatedly, about how when she was suffering from a concussion, he hired black men. They had to be black for Manafort to be satisfied, to gang rape her while he watched, because he's sadistic, and that is what he likes. He is a sadistic, you know, violent human being. And this framing of him as some sort of white-collar criminal, as if white-collar crime itself wasn't violent, because it is. You know, the repercussions of white-collar crime are extremely violent. You know, that is blood money. But, you know, just as an individual, he is a violent man. He should not be out. He should not see the light of day, again, for the good of the country. And it's not about vengeance or anything like that. It's about public safety and about protecting those who are threatened by him.
I had not heard the rape thing. That's, wow.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there's an article. I mean, it came from texts that were written by Manafort's daughters that were verified as authentic. They had texted each other about, you know, mom. They're worried about their mother. Look what dad is up to again, and about how he was evil, how he was, you know, they couldn't believe he was running Trump's campaign. They were sort of joking about it in a very dark way, about how this is a man who will do absolutely anything. And, you know, they talked about his mafia connections. This was all out there. I mean, this is certainly stuff that the government had access to, you know, during the campaign. And I mean, they did absolutely nothing about it. They put him on the Sunday shows. You know, they promoted him like he was just a regular old GOP lobbyist, which is what they continue to do with a number of individuals in this administration. And I think people don't want to see, you know, how dark it can be, how horrible people can be right under your nose because they're wearing a suit and a tie and they have a lot of money, or whatever bias makes you believe that they're better than they are. This is a monster of a human being. And, you know, he's surrounded by fellow monsters, many of whom are in this administration.
Yeah. I'm thinking back to the convention in 2016 in Cleveland, and we broadcast from both conventions. And I remember, you know, meeting a bunch of young kids at the Republican convention who were just tickled to be able to meet Paul Manafort. That was their dream, to meet this guy. And I'm going, wow, I wasn't a fan. I had known some of the Ukraine stuff. I had, you know, some of the stuff. But the depth of depravity, the depth of man's inhumanity to man, I didn't even have a clue of at that point. And I wonder, you know, about those kids today going, you know, if that's the path that they wanted to follow, you know, how far into hell would they go?
Yeah, exactly. And I don't know how they were of it, because, of course, Manafort was promoted by the media and, of course, by Trump in a very different way than he is in reality. And this continued even after the election, even after it was announced in the summer of 2016 that he was being investigated because of his his work, quote unquote, in Ukraine. You still have the New York Times writing these little puff pieces about how Manafort was just a sort of congenial fellow who just happened to live in Trump Tower for 10 years, and they met cute on the elevator, and Trump was like, hey, you want to run my campaign? And Manafort is like, sure, kind fellow. I mean, that is how it read. That was written by Glenn Thrush, who, of course, was outed as a sexual predator months later. And I have to say, if I were Trump, you know, and I was looking for a reporter to cover me, I'd be looking for people who I could blackmail, who have offenses like, say, being a sexual predator, or I'd look for people from dynastic New York families, for example, Maggie Haberman, Glenn Thrush's partner, you know, who go back way, way, you know, way, way back with the Trump family. You know, her mother worked for Trump and Kushner's publicity firm. Her father works for the New York Times. That's what I would do if I were Trump, if I were Roger Stone. I'd start looking for people like that in advance, and I'd deposit them at these papers or records in, 2015. That's what happened. I'm not saying they did it. Just say that's what I would do if I were them. And it would be a very effective strategy because it would mainstream the unthinkable.
Yeah, well, it seems that whether they planned it or not, it worked. But, you know, I look at today, and one of the scary things today to me, and you've been calling this for a very long time, that eventually as an authoritarian figure that Trump wants to be, violence is in the future. And today, it came out that, yesterday he did an interview with Breitbart where he's talking about he's got the support of the police, he's got the support of the military, the bikers for Trump love him. And, they're tough people and, they don't play it tough until they do. And it'll be very, very bad. Very, very bad. And as I was reading that, immediately I started thinking about you and all the times that we've been talking about this and that eventually this is where it gets to.
Yeah, I mean, one of the reasons we've talked about it so much is that this is not at all the first time that Trump has made this kind of threat. You know, he did it constantly in his rallies. In 2016, he said that it would happen if he lost. Roger Stone said there would be a bloodbath if he lost. And, and throughout his presidency, he has made these threats. It's one of those things, sort of like Jared Kushner's security clearance, where suddenly people are all talking about it. And I'm like, this has been a crisis for a long time. And like, while I'm glad you're interested, you need to look at the history and the context of it. And, there are two things going on. Like, yes, Trump absolutely wants a civil war, civic violence, if his position is threatened in any way. And the more chaotic and the weaker the country is, the more people like Trump benefit, because what they are kleptocrats. They are corporate raiders. They are mafiosos. They're not concerned with, like, ordinary people wearing MAGA hats that show up at rallies. They do not give a shit. I mean, he's putting the Harley-Davidson plants out of business. What are the bikers for Trump supposed to ride? I mean, it is such, rank hypocrisy. And that's the other thing he's doing in that statement that I don't think people caught on as well, is his real backers are elite billionaires from around the world, and white supremacists and members of a transnational crime syndicate and other political leaders. That is who is upholding Trump. That is who he cares about. That's where the power is. He doesn't care about these folks, but he needs to put out this impression that he is a regular, blue-collar guy, or like a guy who's loved by the kind of all-American, tough, masculine, worker, like a policeman or a biker or the military, these stereotypical roles. And of course, Trump has never participated and he dodged the draft, and I doubt he could ride a motorcycle or ever has. And it's just, it's his shtick. And he needs to put out that all-American image because he's a traitor. And so, it distracts from that. And people are thinking Trump is kind of like this, neo-Confederate demagogue. And I hope that people see that Trump is actually a member of a transnational crime syndicate that wants to strip America down and sell it for parts. He doesn't care even about his own backers. He doesn't care about the folks at those rallies. And, it's extremely dangerous, but it's also extremely contrived.
And I look at this, and again, this statement, very predictable, setting up that kind of violence that I've been saying for a long time, telling my liberal friends, you should buy guns, because the right wing, they're extremely well armed and fantasizing about shooting people in the streets.
Yeah, I think that. I mean, I live in Missouri, so we are like, I don't know if we're number one in gun violence, but we are always in the top five. We're very well-armed state. You show up at any kind of establishment and he has to explicitly tell you to not bring your weapon in, because the assumption is you will, even if it's like a child's birthday party or something like that. So, I'm familiar with this. I know of people who have joined militias. I don't know how many there are. I sometimes feel like whenever I talk to somebody who's like in D.C., they are like scared shitless of the Trump base. They think that they are all, revved up in, an army of Timothy McVeighs. I don't really find that to be the case. I think the number who are actually militarized are fairly small, but it doesn't take a lot of people to cause a huge problem. And the other thing people aren't thinking about is that in 2016, I think some of that Trump base expected Trump to lose, you know, because Trump kept trying to put himself out there as a victim who was being persecuted and the vote was going to be rigged. And so they invested a lot of money into buying all of these weapons. You know, they really built up arsenals. And I don't know what they've done since. I don't know whether, like you say, they're itching to use them or they sold them for a profit or what. But I think that there are some who have been fantasizing about this fight. You know, we have the situation with the member of the Coast Guard, you know, who was arrested recently for, you know, terrorist planning and wanting to, you know, take out Democrats. We have the MAGA bomber. Like, it doesn't take that many people to cause a problem. And with Trump encouraging them, you know, that's an entirely different level of, you know, crisis. And so, again, it's kind of stupefying to me that he's allowed to just say this, you know, to call for the infliction of violence on other citizens by their own countrymen, to both cause a divide, but a divide that leads to murder and bloodshed. And it's not even in the front of any papers. I think like Judd Legum posted a collage of all the newspapers tomorrow. Like, this doesn't even make the front page. People don't know that this is happening. I'm not quite sure why they don't report it. And then, of course, you have people like Pelosi who don't think it's worth it to impeach him. And I'm just kind of like, what threshold do you want? I mean, the most true thing Trump said is that he could shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue and people would still vote for him. But part of the reason they'd still vote for him is because no one ever impeaches him. No one indicts him. No one takes the gun out of his hands. You know, people look for the smoking gun. It's like he's holding it. He's shooting people with it and you're loading it for him. You know, that's basically how I feel about Pelosi's stance on this.
Right. Well, again, her statement was impeachment is so divisive to the country that unless there's something so compelling and overwhelming and bipartisan, I don't think we should go down that path because it divides the country and he's just not worth it. You know, I don't take that as if she's not willing to impeach him. I'm taking it as she's kind of being dismissive and throwing a shot at him that, you know what, yeah, he's just not worth it. Now, look, I've been saying for a while, you know, if all of these things, the Mueller report comes out and there's stuff there, absolutely impeach him. But my fear is it is divisive that you're not going to have Republicans come along and we're going to end up reliving the 90s where we're completely focused on the impeachment while everything else goes to hell, while everything else is going to hell.
Yeah, but I think we're already there. You know, we're already divisive. We're already collapsing. We're already falling apart. And we're falling apart because they're committing crimes with impunity. And the focus of impeachment hearings would be the crimes. It would be the presentation of evidence in the public sphere to citizens free of media bias, which I think is very beneficial because most people get their news from, you know, information silos, like from Fox News or from MSNBC or from, you know, a Facebook disinformation group. The exception to this has been the hearings, you know, has been Comey, has been Cohen. It's a time where the nation comes together and they bear witness to this. And I think that, you know, we've had some of this in oversight hearings, and I'm for that as well. But the problem with what Pelosi said, you know, she'd wanted to say it had to be, you know, overwhelming. And of course, we need to gather evidence first, although much of that evidence already exists in the public domain. That I understand. It was the bipartisan part because, by definition, the GOP are implicated in Trump's crimes. You know, we just had Cohen's testimony. Cohen was the deputy treasurer of the Republican National Committee. You know, these were not minor players. And we have a wealth of senators and representatives who have been, you know, called to testify in the Mueller probe or who have been, you know, indicted in terms of campaign managers and things like this, and or have received dark money or have been, I mean, this is the crucial thing, they defend Trump even though his crimes are in the public domain, even though Trump, you know, he commits obstruction of justice. And then he goes on TV and he tells Lester Holt how he commits obstruction of justice. And they just stand by him because they have to, because they are now complicit. You know, Trump has spun a web of complicity that is so vast that it has ensnared potentially every member of the Republican Party, either, you know, just through the acceptance of dirty money, something like that. And I think he's also scaring people. I think that a lot of people are being threatened. And so that's a problem. And I think Nancy Pelosi knows this. And so she knows there will never be a bipartisan move to impeach. And so then you have to say, well, then why is this in the Constitution? Why do we have this rule? You know, this is supposed to protect our country. It's supposed to make a statement about what we accept and what we will tolerate and what we condemn. And I think that, you know, given that he's committed a large number of impeachable offenses, it's not one small thing. They're not out there desperately searching for a secret blowjob. I mean, this is, you know, obstruction of justice, high crimes and misdemeanors, emoluments, abuse of the pardon system. I mean, all sorts of things. Like, easy to impeach if you have the will, if you have the courage, and if you have, you know, commitment to your country. And I worry that either they lack it or that they are so terrified by this mafia state that they're unwilling to act, that that's the actual cause and not this quote-unquote divisiveness. Because, I mean, I can't remember a time that we weren't divisive, because I can, you know, really barely remember before the 90s. And so it ain't news to me that we're, you know, falling apart at the seams in terms of a lack of bipartisanship.
No, I'm with you. But, I look at Pelosi's position. She's in a position where in the House they could probably get the Democrats to issue articles of impeachment. And then it heads to the Senate where the Democrats don't have the power. And I don't see that the 12 Republicans that voted against the fake emergency, I don't see any of them flipping to vote for impeach. So it would be one of these things where it looked like the Democrats were just being highly partisan.
I don't think it would look like that, though, because they would be examining the actual crimes and the evidence and putting it in the public domain. And, you know, the public has the right to this information, and they have the right to make up their own mind. And I don't think everyone in the public is going to be convinced. You know, you're certainly going to have Trump's base still supporting him. But, you know, if you look at Nixon's hearings, for example, as in the beginning, you know, most people were taking his side, particularly most Republicans. As time went on and they got into the extension of the crime and the cover-up, his approval sank and people wanted him out. And we have a different situation here, because even if this happened and the Senate was pressured, or they just, you know, saw the light and they decided to convict Trump, he would still not leave. You know, he would just sit there, and it wouldn't be like a Bill Clinton style sitting there where, you know, he was impeached and he went on to continue, you know, to run the country in a flawed but, you know, fairly traditional manner. He would sit there and have like a fit. I mean, he's never going to leave. I mean, even if he loses in the election, he still wouldn't go. And so this whole issue of like, oh, gee, what if the Senate doesn't convict? You know, he's going to try to act like a martyr. Like, that's what he does every damn day. Like, right. It doesn't matter what the Democrats do. You know, it doesn't matter what any of us do in reality, because he invents his own reality. And he goes out to his rallies and he says everybody's out to get him and it's a witch hunt. And he's this blameless, innocent person, just like Paul Manafort. You know, it's all crap. I mean, he lies all the time. He lies about, you know, evil migrants, you know, snatching babies and putting Hezbollah members in their ranks. You know, he lies compulsively, so of course he'll lie about this. But I think that a process like hearings where there isn't, you know, the media poking in, whether liberal media or conservative media, where you're just sort of seeing it straight and you can make your own decisions, I think that that's very good for all Americans. It doesn't matter if you like him or not, if you're disillusioned or you're ramped up, like whatever. It's good for everybody to just see this bear out. So at the least, we should be having oversight hearings. But I think oversight without a goal, you know, without consequences, it is not a good idea, because it implies that no matter what happens, how bad the evidence is, he will just walk away scot-free, which is what he's done his whole life.
Yeah, but, you know, here again, aren't they having hearings? Aren't we, you know, isn't that the game plan here? They're going after the tax returns. They're going after, you know, things to redo most of the hearings that the Republicans tried to, you know, gloss over. And they're really waiting for the Mueller report. To me, I think everybody's been holding their breath for so long for this report to come out that, you know, everything else has kind of just been stalled.
It's been stalled, I think, more because the GOP dominated all the sections of Congress. And so, of course, they were torpedoing hearings right and left. And so now, you know, we are getting hearings. I think what would have been better for Pelosi to do is just not say anything, just sort of say, yeah, we're in the process of having hearings and we're, you know, looking at evidence and we're weighing the evidence we couldn't get access to because the Republicans obstructed it. Like, that would have been useful. And they just not made a definitive statement, because by saying that impeachment is off the table, which is what that means when you say you need a bipartisan consensus to get there, and you know the GOP is not going to impeach themselves. yourself. I mean, that's what you're asking them to do if you ask them to join in on this, because they're implicated in a state crime. You know, I think that that was unwise. I mean, I do hope they continue to have the hearings in general, you know, for the good of the country. I would not put that much faith in the Mueller report. I mean, he's like the Godot of investigators, and everyone waits for him, and it's like every week we hear it's coming out. Like, it's also, I think a lot of the information in that report is going to be things that we've already known, in part because of journalistic investigations, but often because they confess their crimes. You know, Donald Trump Jr. puts his emails on Twitter. You know, we've got Cohen and Sater's emails saying that they're going to install Trump in the White House with the help of Putin, you know, written in 2015. We've got Donald Trump himself confessing to crimes and committing crimes openly, right, and left. So I think that it's just going to confirm, you know, a lot of things you already knew and put it in a formal way, or it might not, or it might get censored by Barr, or it might be self-censored, or it might never see the light of day. We don't know. So I think that it's not a great idea to sort of put all your eggs in the Mueller basket. I think that, you know, you should use your common sense and your conscience and just look at what these people have been doing. Look at how our country has been run. Look at the crimes that are happening right before your eyes and say, yes, that is happening. I'm not crazy. But what's crazy is that no one is doing anything to stop it, because it's extremely destructive and dangerous for our country.
No, I'm with you. But sadly, I'm probably guilty of it, too. I keep waiting for this damn report. I keep waiting. Where is it?
It's frustrating. I mean, everyone's waiting. You read about the old people, the people who are trying to hang on, you know, to life so that they could read the Mueller report. I mean, but I have to say, you know, there's always this kind of beltway attitude of like regular people don't care about the Mueller probe, which it's just total crap. And I think that that article proved it. When you've got the nursing homes filled with people who are like, just give me a few more days, you know, dear Lord, so I could get the Mueller report, like you've got a very desirable product that people want to know because they're worried about their country. And, you know, that's what it comes down to.
Yeah, I mean, the latest bit of intrigue now that Manafort's done is now, I guess everything's turning back to Rick Gates and what he's spilling, because evidently this could just keep going on and on and on as this bad soap opera. Like, you know, you watch some of those daytime soap operas that have been on like 40 years and it's the same storyline over and over again. That's the thing that bothers me. This is turning into.
It is a lot like that. I used to watch The Bold and the Beautiful, and I remember I went through like a 3-year period of not watching it, and then I went back and watched it. I knew exactly what was going on. Because they just recycle things. I think there's a different actor playing one of the characters, but I mean, I could see that happening because we're like at that level of insanity. I hadn't heard about the latest with Rick Gates, but you know, I am pro this investigation going on for the rest of my life. If I am going to become one of those elderly people waiting for the Mueller report at age 90, then so be it, you know, because the thing is, this is deep corruption. Just as it may take 40 years to undo this, to uncover what has been done, this plot has been in play for about 40 years, like basically since Watergate. That's when you found this collection of, you know, rogue Republican, extremely dirty actors, you know, Stone and Manafort and all these other Roy Cohn proteges. You have things like Iran-Contra, where the criminals get pardoned. You know, now we, of course, have Barr, who is the pardoner, as the attorney general, which does not bode well. We have unpunished crimes from the Iraq War. We have unpunished crimes from the 2008 financial crash and, you know, Wall Street white-collar criminal impunity, and it's all converged in the Trump administration. And so if they want to investigate that, you know, until climate change kills us all, I'm cool with that. I don't think that's a waste of money or time. I think that's getting to the truth and trying to bring some justice and some consequences and prevent it from happening again, to make a deterrent, to make it like, hey, you know, if I want to go out and do that, I'm going to end up like Paul Manafort in jail instead of like Paul Manafort, you know, having billions of dollars and like, you know, living the high life and getting away with things. Like, people should look at this and say, I don't want to be part of that. One, because it's evil, but, you know, also because maybe crime doesn't pay. I would like to live in an America where crime does not pay. I have never lived in that America in my life. But, you know, a good time to start is now.
Now, as I've always said, behind every great billionaire is a great crime. And we see that played out off and often. But here's the thing. I listened to you, and what popped into my head is, boy, aren't you little Miss Ray of Sunshine? Until we're going to do this until climate change kills us all. As if this isn't bad enough, you're going to throw that on top of it.
I'm just being realistic. I mean, honestly, that's another one of those crises that I think, people need to be much more assertive about solving. And it's also directly linked to the corruption of the Trump administration. You know, we have an administration that is not going to do anything to resolve climate change in terms of curbing fossil fuels, putting out new regulations, doing a Green New Deal. They're not going to do that. And, you know, our lives are at stake. My children's lives are at stake. When I look into the future, a dream world is me being 90 years old waiting for the Mueller probe results. Like, that sounds good to me because that means I live to be 90 and hopefully my kids, you know, lived and I got to be a grandma and like all those things that I want out of life. But to do that, you know, we do need to tackle these problems head on, because I think if this administration has taught us anything, if you can't let these crimes and these atrocities just fester without taking action. You know, if people had gone after Manafort when he first started committing crimes, like in the 90s, probably the 80s, we wouldn't be in this situation now. And that's true of a number of people, including Trump. And so the same thing is true with climate change. If they'd gone after it aggressively in the 80s, we wouldn't be in as much trouble now. And so again, you know, the time to start is now. It's not, I mean, in some extent, it's too late, but I think, you know, what you want to do is mitigate the damage so that people just don't suffer as much. I think that's a really simple goal, and I think that that's something we should strive for.
You liberal, you don't want people to suffer.
Yeah, silly me.
So lastly, last thing I got for you, again, back to the Mueller report. Do we expect this anytime soon? Because I had someone tell me that it was going to be tomorrow. I've had people say, well, you know, wait till the end of May. Or is it just a crapshoot? Any thoughts?
I don't know. I mean, I don't even think about that. I think about what may be in it. I worry about the process of delivery. I worry about it being censored. I worry whether the people in it will actually be indicted. I don't know, and I also don't know what it means for it to be handed in, whether that's just the end and people who we know are dangerous criminals, like Jared Kushner, for example, are not indicted. Like, that's the aspect of it that concerns me far more than the report itself, because I think we know such a wealth of information already about what they've done that we don't necessarily need it, and it's more of like an indication of the process of justice itself, the integrity of the system, whether this will be honored, whether Republicans will seek to censor it, whether Mueller did a thorough job, because, you know, I do have some issues with some of the things he's done, mostly letting Michael Flynn, the nuke fetishist psychopath, just walk around free, even though a judge was like, you need to lock this guy up, like he's going to blow up the world. I obviously disagree with Mueller on that, but, you know, I do want to see it. I don't think it's the end-all, be-all. I think we need to look at the big picture, the big kind of systemic rot that we're facing that no one report or no one man or woman could possibly fix.
I know I said last thing, but, you know, I just had to get one more thing. The most important story of the entire week, since you brought up Kushner and criminal, the college cheating scandal. You know, the most pressing story of the day that got more headlines than probably anything that we've talked about thus far.
Yeah.
Thoughts?
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm going to promote my book. I have a book, The View from Flyover Country, of essays I wrote between 2012 and 2015. And one of those essays is called The Immorality of College Admissions. And it talks about this level of corruption. I mean, well, not this level, not something like the kind of explicit, enormous payouts that involved Hollywood celebrities, but about education being something you purchase through things like private schools, expensive SAT tutors, expensive extracurricular activities, and the fact that merit, you know, is now a purchase commodity, and people become locked out of the system. And as a result, you've got a bunch of really lackluster individuals put into positions of power in fields like media and policy. And, you know, and I wrote this 6 years ago, I guess. And now I'm looking at what's going on, and you see people like, for example, Ivanka and Jared, you know, who embody the system completely. Like, Jared Kushner bought his way into Harvard and now has ascended to the White House through no merit or qualification of his own, just through nepotism and wealth, and is destroying the world. So this is not just a situation of unfairness. it represents a danger, you know, as these recipients of nepotism and wealth grow older for America. You know, an unequal society, income inequality of this nature is dangerous as a national security concern. So that's an argument to consider, I guess.
Yeah, I was expecting this is not new. It's been going on.
Look,
George Bush got into Yale. He couldn't get into the University of Texas.
Yeah, it's just gotten worse. I mean, it's definitely not new. There's always been legacy admissions. It's always been rigged. But just like everything else, income inequality, it's become progressively more so basically since the Reagan era onward, since like about the late 70s onward.
Yay, fun stuff. Sarah, I appreciate the time. I hope you'll come back and talk to us again real soon. Always fun.
Thank you.
Thanks so much, Sarah Kendzior, host of the podcast Gaslit Nation. Highly, highly suggested. Also author of the book, A View from Flyover Country. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. Listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.